Well, welcome to the September podcast. And gosh, there's so many things to talk about, it's hard to know where to start. But I thought it would be useful, maybe, to chat a bit about where we are and why we are on a sort of an innovation cycle of technology and learning. It's always good to know exactly where you are on the cycle. And I think it's much misunderstood. As a consequence, people end up chasing off in the wrong direction. This all works on a 10-year cycle, though I have to say the 10-year cycle is just compressing a little bit because everything moves so quickly. And I'm just going to sort of narrate that a little bit for you, and then it'll help you to realise where we are. I'll chat a bit about why that matters just at this moment in technology and learning. Well, you've got to go back a long way to see the beginning of this cycle, back to 1975. In fact, I'm jolly old, so just about remember that far back. And back in 1975, there was a great debate about whether this was going to be the microcomputer or the mainframe that was going to dominate the world. You know, in companies, the guys in charge of the mainframe were the respected high-status people, and then the people left looking after the micros were, I think, seen very much as on a part of the people servicing the typewriters. But that model of a great big mainframe computer delivering to the world, you know, Asimov's kind of science fiction model of one huge brain, you know, of course didn't really catch on, because the flexibility of individual computer, the personal computer, was way too seductive. So the cycle begins in 1975, and what you see always with this cycle is a movement between people and communities doing exceptional things, and then governments and corporations coming in with large-scale solutions, or what they think are solutions. So the people and the communities, the innovators, the pioneers, if you like, with new tools, were very much those early microcomputer programmers, and very many of them were, certainly in England, were sitting in garages. Some of them were young kids hacking away with their very early computers to try and write a bit of code and try and make the computer do something. And some of those bits of code you still see sloshing around now, you know, sort of biorhythms and goodness knows what else. Golf games, you know, built entirely on a sort of matrix of piece of graph paper. You played the golf game with a coordinate, you hit it with a 5 and a long pause, and the computer would come back with two numbers, and they were the coordinates of where the supposed ball had landed. I mean, this wasn't a very graphical world. But those hero innovators were their core tools. You could see they were doing something that was really, really important. And as a result of that, governments stood up and took notice, and indeed so did corporations. And what you start to see always when governments and corporations take notice, I mean, first, it takes them a bit of time, you know, typically about half a decade. And secondly, they always think, well, this is going to be about content. We better get some stuff together. Of course, maybe for them it is about content. So by about 1980, governments were starting to focus on, all over the world, on setting up programs to write little bits of software that would become learning software. In Britain, the Microelectronics Education Programme, hugely ambitious programme, regional centres and a real focus on robotics and on computer-based learning and goodness knows what else, took a substantial whack of money, and some of the brightest minds in Britain were focused into that big group. What you get, though, and you'll see this cycle repeats over and over and over, decade after decade, this big emphasis on content, of course, isn't it? For a whole heap of reasons. I mean, not the least of which being that as we were heading towards a 21st century that was going to be made up of, you know, peer-to-peer learning in a very viral, agile, personal way, and personalised learning rather than individualised learning, you know, learning that suited you was blended to your context and culture rather than learning that you did on your own. As we move towards that sort of world, you know, these big heavy-duty lumps of content really didn't deliver. They were left from a vision of learning from the Victorian age, you know, when people delivered a curriculum, children received wisdom, you know, it was all a very one-way thing. So of course we're moving to a symmetrical world, and it's that movement to symmetry that is at the heart of this tension between people and communities, the hero innovators that do cool stuff, and then governments and corporations producing large content. Not to say that the large content is wasted or unnecessary. It's just useful for you to know where we are on the cycle at any time. And after that content is produced, as indeed was the case around the sort of early 1980s, people start to feel really uncertain. They think, hang on a minute, this isn't it. Now, in a rather jolly way, in that uncertainty, nobody quite knows what to talk about. So they always invent terms, and we'll have a bit of fun as we hurtle towards 2005 and have a little bit of fun looking at what those silly terms were. In around about the 1980s, you'd turn up at a conference and people would talk about the impact of programming languages on learning. You know, you'd have conferences on Lisp and Prolog, whether Pascal was it, you know, UCSD was the future and the way and the light or whatever. So, you know, people fill in time in that uncertainty period by talking about nonsense, really, and that comes back time and time and time again. So there's our first 10-year cycle, going from will it be the micro, will it be the mainframe, it's the micro. So you've got that key moment that occurs every 10 years. Then the hero innovators with new tools producing extraordinary stuff, which is indicative enough to governments and corporations that they want to be in the game. Takes them about 5 years. They produce content. Content isn't really it. We fall into uncertainty. During the uncertainty, we talk about nonsense. That leads us back to the next peak, and of course, 10 years later, the next peak, 1985, this was desktop publishing. The first PostScript laser printer appeared in 1985. It was fearfully expensive. I think it was about 5,000 quid. A lot of money, and $7,500 or whatever. Vast amounts of money, but nevertheless, it was a complete revolution. People could take their computer, take the words which were now starting to appear on the computer in a graphical kind of way. Remember, the first Macintosh was 1984. So you'd already got a mouse and windows and pull-down menus and drawing packages and letters that looked like letters and not a command line anymore. And that graphical representation could now suddenly magically be produced through PostScript as print-quality stuff, you know, which was a revolution. And previously, big capital had got in the way. If you had great poems that you wanted to publish, you'd try and find a publisher where the literary editor thought that your poems were as good as you did, and then maybe, you know, they'd put their capital behind it and the book would be produced. And if you were very wealthy, you put up your own capital in a sort of vanity publishing sort of way. But, you know, it needed a big lump of money. Well, with desktop publishing, anybody could produce anything. And I remember going to early conferences where the publishers were very worried about the impact of desktop publishing on quality. You know, if we're not using our literary editors, where will this lead quality? Anybody can publish a poem. Poems will be shocking. But of course, what happened was, coming straight off the back of 1985, those hero innovators with new tools produce things for themselves and for each other. The symmetry thing, you see, you always get straight after each peak, you always get the people not producing stuff to deliver it or to become a provider. They're doing it for themselves and for each other. This is a people thing, and it's a symmetry thing. So what they, of course, did was to harness tools like PageMaker and produced a whole new bunch of genre. Of course, we had, you know, fanzines, parish magazines, handouts. I mean, never ever sit down now in any kind of event. People don't give you a handout that was produced on a computer, and they're all best print quality. But this hasn't really threatened the book market. It's added breadth to the book market. And of course, what was interesting after 1985 was that people started to think really hard about publishing in all sorts of new genre, which included on the screen. And you had the beginning of Bill Atkinson's wonderful HyperCard. Quite extraordinary, quite pivotal. Really did change the world. And there were people producing their own seductive educational programs to teach children to write stories, to teach about biometric cell culture. Goodness knows what else, you know. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. Analysing Beethoven and a million others. But this was very much sort of new genre of publishing. Well, quite quickly, of course, within 5 years, governments and corporations started to say, flick, this is really important. A few of those hero innovators passed over into the corporations. One or two of them made pretty good money, briefly. But, of course, that wasn't it. And you had to, you will remember, there was an absolute flurry of multimedia as people were producing all sorts of extraordinary stuff most of which weren't quite it. So the content thing grew and grew and grew, but none of that content was really quite it. And the multimedia industry struggled to be an industry and struggled to find a channel and didn't quite know who to sell to. But it was fascinating times, and there was some real innovation. And I think probably of all the moments of large-scale corporate and government innovation, that was one of the most interesting periods. But it wasn't quite it, and people could feel the approach of new formats, and of course the CD-ROM. Remember that in the middle of this, CD-ROMs were there for audio, and some of that early HyperCard stuff ran on your computer and controlled the CD disc itself, rather than being a multimedia on the CD, so to speak. These were pioneering days. These were 1990. Was about the middle of this period. But that government and corporation stuff wasn't it. I mean, quite a lot of the governments and corporations started to go bankrupt from the cost of trying to produce CD-ROMs. They kept producing CD-ROMs that they thought would be, a wonderful prototype for the next 20. But of course, the next 20 things had moved on, so it was only a prototype for the one. So the cost of producing each CD was fantastically expensive. I remember having arguments with publishers who would phone up, and we were producing CDs too. The Renaissance Project ran for Apple was a fascinating piece of research, where we said, just what might we do with CD-ROMs when they're out and available? Fascinating times. Nobody knew. So in the uncertainty that followed that 1990-ish period, what were we talking about at conferences? Well, I wasn't, because hopefully a bit more sensible, but conferences, you'd turn up and you'd find people talking about CD-ROM formats. I mean, staggeringly boring. But then that's what always happens in this period of uncertainty. And they'd talk about CD-ROM, CDXA, CDI. Gosh, you remember CDI? You could see it wasn't going to make it, because the lags were just too great, weren't they? In the hardware and software. But nevertheless, that was what people talked about. And it filled a period between governments and corporations realizing that this stuff mattered, and suddenly realizing that what they were doing wasn't quite it, and sitting back to wait for the next great thing. And of course, the next big thing, of course, was the internet. And you can see the period starting to shorten a little bit now. I mean, we ought to project that 1995 would be the point at which those hero innovators would start to harness the new thing, the World Wide Web. In fact, I think one could fairly say that really happened in about 1994. And remember, sort of end of 93, the code was just about being released, and Mosaic was a beta level browser, and that was about the only thing you'd got. So certainly for most of the people listening to this, you could have bought your first name.com as a domain in 1994. So that was the beginning of all this. And of course, the eyes came off the ball of desktop publishing and all those new publishing genre, including multimedia, that followed it. And suddenly there were our hero innovators again, producing web pages, doing really cool stuff, working with Hot Metal Pro, moving into Flash and JavaScript and all sorts of really interesting things, where before they'd been in Video Works and then Director and so on. So they got great new tools, and PageMaker of 1985 became the ability to create and edit a web page in 1994-95, and it was all pretty exciting stuff. And pretty difficult in the early days, all sorts of things that none of us knew about, scratching our heads and puzzling with, but produced some pretty exciting projects. And for me, I got involved in some wonderful learning community things coming off the back of all that. And you could see that within about 5 years, as we might predict, those hero innovators, and they're all around the world, of course, and what was particularly special about the mid-90s, not only were they all around the world, but you could immediately see each other's stuff, where with desktop publishing and multimedia, you had to go to conferences to see each other's stuff, and you'd always come back with your bag stuff with CDs and bits of paper that other people had produced. The great thing about the web was you immediately saw other people's stuff, and that sure I take did accelerate the whole thing, moving towards that economics world of perfect competition, where everybody is a producer and everybody's a consumer and everybody knows what everybody else is doing. Lovely world. And of course, on the back of all that web innovation, governments think, crumbs, we better be part of this. and corporations think we'd better be part of this. And typically they went for producing a lot of content and wanting to be a portal. You know, I've got nothing useful to say, but if I'm a portal, everybody will come to me on the way to people who have got something useful to say. Kind of dream, you know, everybody wants to be a portal. Usually being a portal is usually the simple admittance that you're not actually doing anything useful. But one or two of those portals, of course, turned out to be very helpful indeed. The BBC, with government funding in the UK, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds of digital content, and companies too, throwing money at producing content for the World Wide Web, and then spending a lot of time and a lot of angst worrying about IPR, you know, how they could protect their content in a world where everybody was sharing stuff. Probably the long-term answer is they can't, you know, but anyway, perhaps more of that in another podcast. But that isn't quite it, is it? And many of those dot-com corporations, or for that matter, those e-learning innovations, all started to founder because, of course, you know, content isn't king. This is about symmetry. It's about people doing things with each other and for each other. It isn't about somebody doing it for them and then delivering it to them and selling it on a large scale. Symmetry was the last century, sort of asymmetrical in one direction. Symmetry that's two-way is this century, and people just take ages to get the hang of that. So in that uncertainty that followed, again, people started to talk about funny terms that meant nothing. In this case, as we are heading towards, around about the turn of the millennium at this point, of course, the things people are talking about are to do with learning, because they can see the impact of all this on learning. People talk about e-learning and blended learning and learning objects, as though any learning could not be blended, as though any object wasn't a learning object, as though, well, you know, you can imagine. But it gives people something to talk about in the interim, and papers get written, and people in universities are kept happy, you know. What's interesting is that the smart people in the governments and corporations at each of these times realise that the future isn't just them providing. They realise that the future is going to be about those innovators and new tools for a while. And it's fascinating to see right the way across the piece, you know, in around 1980, around 1990, around 2000, people starting to adjust their vision of what that big content might be, to include a little bit of tool base. And if you look at the BBC Digital Curriculum, which of course is late because of all sorts of legal challenges and so on, so it's rather usefully a little bit late for the government and corporation bit, and just a little bit early for the next big thing, which we'll come to in a minute. So you can see that being adjusted, for example, to put tools in it and to give people the ability to be hero innovators within the content. And that's a really, really fascinating development, because then you can start to see the government and corporations end of this cycle and the people and communities end of this cycle starting to come together. And at that point, wow, then we really are cooking with gas. So what happened next? Well, of course, it's a world of user-generated content that followed on from the world of the internet. It's a world where people are making and creating things for each other, in many cases, by the act of communicating. Extraordinary talking heads community of head teachers in the UK, which I was proud to be a dad of, really. you know, put together, what, 20,000 head teachers or whatever it is. And of course, in the conversations that they were having, they were generating the content that then went on to provide useful information, useful basis for conversation for the head teachers that followed them the year after and the year after. This sense of a self-regenerative world where the content that you produce feeds the people who follow behind is a very powerful one. And of course, we've now got those new tools appearing for user-generated content. This has all happened a little bit early. It all started to happen 2003, 2004, really. But of course, the real impetus is starting to happen in 2005. So we're not a million miles away still from this big 10-year cycle. You know, we're through the government corporation stage. We've passed through the zone of uncertainty. By the way, in those zones of uncertainty, you know, coming off the back of 1980, coming off the back of 1990, coming off the back of 2000, those are the times when some of the big research teams fold up, you know, when you lose some of the really big groups in, you know, Nortel, Lucent, Bell, some of the some of the Media Lab in Dublin goes to the wall, and so on. I mean, and they all disappear, because in a zone of uncertainty, it's very hard to see what their role is. So if you're out there listening to this in a fairly innovative lab, you know, watch out for that 2010 period, because, you know, in the kind of 8-9 zone, that's, my goodness, that's when you're going to be vulnerable. Anyway, what are the new tools that the Hero Innovators are using? Well, of course, we're talking on one now. It's podcasting, it's blogs, it's news feeds. But it's also, I think, and this is where it gets really interesting, it's also, of course, portable technologies like mobile phones. And it's fascinating that I certainly got involved in my first mobile phone learning project in schools way back in the 90s. And we've all been, I think, very late in coming to innovation in this area. In a later podcast, I'll talk more about mobiles in learning. But you can see that there's a tool which isn't about people sitting, watching and receiving. It's a tool about people creating and making and delivering. And indeed, one or two of the big mobile phone operators continually miss the point by advertising and suggesting that, you know, sign up to our network and you can watch David Beckham scoring goals. What people want to do, of course, is sign up to a network and do a bit of video flirting with their boyfriend or girlfriend, or swap some messages or jokes and have fun and pass back and forward in a kind of peer-to-peer, viral, agile sort of community of practice world that we would have predicted would be happening around about now, because it happens every 10 years. So, that's most of what I wanted to say to you in this podcast. It's an awful lot to get your head around. Believe me, if you're listening to this in the commercial sector, if you know where you are on the cycle, that's your secret to, you know, which riches and wealth beyond your dreams. If you're listening to this in research, you can see that round about now would be a very good time to be focusing on research projects that focused around podcasting and blogs and RSS and mobile phones and MMS and those sort of things, because it's that hero innovator tool end of the world that we're in at the moment. And if you're looking to see what you might be doing by about 2010, of course, you'll be working with governments on some sort of, and corporations, on some sort of large-scale phone-based or newsfeed-based or podcast-based service. Last little thought to leave you with is to think of the way that those dreadful recent bombings in London on the 7th of July, a lot of that material was captured by people with phones who just captured it and passed it to each other. You sense that these viral person-to-person, peer-to-peer tools are extraordinarily powerful. I remember seeing two or three of the news websites the day after rather plaintively saying, I think it was the Washington Post maybe, rather plaintively saying, if you've got any video footage on your mobile phone, could you send it to us, please? You know, can we be part of the action? You can see that government and corporation, we want to provide a service, we want to provide or deliver to people, is hugely threatened by these peer-to-peer, people-to-people, people and community things. I don't think it's a war. It's not people fighting against governments. It's just a very clear cycle that you move in. But what gets to be interesting, if you look back over that whole period from the micro through to desktop publishing, to the web, now through to user-generated content, what you see is that the impetus, the progress, the excitement is increasingly with the people in the communities side of the cycle and the innovators with new tools, and the moribund, not quite got it right end, which, you know, back in the 1980s was the government with the MEP, you know, doing some really innovative stuff. You can see that struggles, absolutely struggles, to be the coolest bit of the cycle. Well, the jury's out of what it's going to do in the next 5 and 10 or 15 years, but trust me, this 10-year cycle, slightly compressed, is the world we're in, because it's not a technology cycle, it's a people cycle. That is honestly about as far and as fast as people can go at a time. That's what locks us into the 10-year bit. Well, this is about as fast as I can go in a podcast too, so thanks for listening. These things are monthly, so more of the same next month, and thank you, the extraordinarily large numbers of you, to my amazement, that are tuning into all this. Keep in touch, and bye for now.